Welcome in, everyone, to another episode of the Real Estate Tax Playbook, where we discuss all things real estate, providing timely and precise tax information to real estate professionals looking to build their own customized tax planning playbook. I'm your host, Evan Ross. I'm a tax director with Brown Edwards & Company based out of our Roanoke, Virginia office. If you're unfamiliar with Brown Edwards & Company, please go check out our website. A link to that site can be found in the description of that podcast of this podcast. You'll find more information on our service lines as well as our locations and some of our other service providers. With all that being said, I'd like to introduce to you our guest for today, Claudia Kiernan with IPX 1031. Claudia, thanks for being with us here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be on this podcast with you.
Very good. Well, before we get started, I know you really enjoy traveling. Have you been on any exciting trips as of late or this year?
Well, end of last year, I did get to go to Brighton, England. So that was nice to visit some family there. And then we went to London and then, And then in the summer, the end of the summer, a couple of weeks, we're going to go up to Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. Yeah.
Very good. That sounds exciting. My wife and I are planning a trip to London and Paris next year. So I'll have to get some tips from you on the travel arrangements. So.
That'll be a lot of fun.
Very good. Well, before we get into our topic for today, just wanted to kind of give you a chance to kind of introduce yourself, your role with IXP 1031 and kind of what you all do.
Sure. Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. So I'm actually a regional manager with Investment Property Exchange Services, and we're what is known as a qualified intermediary for 1031 tax deferred exchanges. So simply, we're the company that makes the 1031 exchange happen. We hold the funds, we create all the exchange documents, but we're a nationwide qualified intermediary. I'm one of the attorneys here and a regional manager. But we do all types of exchanges, the delayed forward where you sell and you buy, the reverse exchange, improvement exchanges.
Very good. Very good. Well, with all that, let's go ahead and get into the topic for today. You kind of mentioned it in your intro, but 1031 exchanges. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have heard of 1031 exchanges, been involved with them before, but do you mind kind of just giving a brief background overview of the purpose of a 1031 exchange and how that can impact real estate investors and professionals?
Absolutely. Yeah. And by the way, code 1031 has been around or part of the Internal Revenue Code for over 100 years. And it's interesting to me how many people don't really know about a 1031, or maybe they have some misunderstanding about it. But it is considered one of the biggest wealth building tools we have, and also an economic stimulus for our economy. And the reason why is because a 1031 exchange allows someone to sell a property either held for investment purposes or a use in a business or a trade through the use of a qualified intermediary, exchange that for another property held for investment purposes or business or use in trade. And what that does, it allows someone to defer all the taxes that would ordinarily be due. So instead of writing that big check to the IRS or maybe to your state, you get to keep those funds and use them to reinvest in more real estate. So the idea is, again, to encourage people to, when they sell a property, to reinvest in more real estate.
Very good. Yep. Taxpayers are always looking for a way to defer taxes down the road. So this is a great opportunity to do that. You mentioned that IXP 1031 is a qualified intermediary. Is that required for a 1031 exchange? You can't just go in and say, hey, I want to do a 1031 exchange and do it on your own. Is that
correct? No, absolutely. A qualified intermediary is required for the 1031 exchange because we provide several vital functions in the 1031. So, you know, the IRS stipulates that there must be an exchange, right, or a trade. And so what we're doing is we're creating that exchange by being a part of both transactions, the sale and the purchase. So we're actually assigning into the sale contract. So we step in the shoes of our client, become the seller, And then we're also doing that at the purchase side. We're assigning into the replacement property. The other role that we're providing is that when you want to do a 1031 exchange, you know, typically at the closing, you're going to receive the funds from the sale. Well, in an exchange, you cannot do that. You can't receive it, actually receive them or constructively. So what we're also doing is we are holding the funds for our clients. And then thirdly, we're providing the documentation that's required. So there's several documents that we prepare for an exchange. By the way, the exchange has to be set up prior to the closing, right? You can't close and then call us up and say, hey, I'd like to do a 1031 exchange. So what are we going to do before the closing is we got to create that exchange agreement. And that exchange agreement is super important because it's simply it's connecting or it's the nexus between what someone is selling and what someone is buying. Of course, there's a lot more things that it's doing in there, but so you have the exchange agreement and the assignment. So yes, you have to use a qualified intermediary. Unfortunately, you can't use, you know, your attorney, your CPA or tax advisor or your realtor or a family member, because they would be disqualified.
Very good. Very good. And you mentioned timing. You mentioned this, you can't close before the exchange. Is there a case where you find a replacement property before the close? Is that possible, or does that the replacement property need to be after?
Yeah, interesting. You know, so the majority of the exchanges we do, and we're considered the largest qualified intermediary out there. So we do a good amount of them, but the majority of the ones that we do, like 80% of them all, they are what we call a delayed exchange, right? It's truly got to be an exchange. We relinquish one and we acquire another one. So a lot of times, however, in this market, we may have a situation where client calls me and says, Claudia, I want to do a 1031 exchange, but I have a problem. And I'm like, well, what's the problem? And they say, well, I found the perfect replacement property, but the seller doesn't want to wait till I close on my relinquished property. So I need to buy this one first. So unfortunately, they can't just go buy it and then call us up and say, again, Claudia, you know, I want to do a reverse exchange. I've already bought this property. Reason being is, it has to be an exchange, right? If they buy a property and they sell and they have the other one, they can't own both properties at the same time. So it's truly got to be an exchange. So what we got to do is a little more involved than our regular delayed exchange. We actually go on title to the replacement property, park it until our client sells the relinquished property. So it's one of those type of transactions that most of our clients don't aim for, but in case they need to do it, they have that there as a fallback. Some of our large or business contacts, like say someone has a warehouse and they do manufacturing and they need a bigger warehouse, well, they can't really afford to do a delayed exchange where they close down one of the properties and sell it and then purchase. So they'll do a reverse exchange. They'll buy that replacement property, get that all set up, maybe even do some improvements on it or some build outs, and then sell the relinquished property. So absolutely, there's the ability to do a reverse exchange.
Okay. Well, that's good to know, even though it is sounds like it is somewhat uncommon. It's at least good to know that that option is available if those kind of situations do arise. I did want to ask, what kind of property is qualifying for a 1031 exchange? So there's so many people get, I think if there's real property, there's the land, there's rental property, residential, commercial. What qualifies? What can you do? What can't you do
Yeah.
as far as the type of property?
Yeah, it's interesting because so many people have a misunderstanding of this. And I think it's maybe because of how the code section's written, which states that the property you sell and the property you buy must be like kind. So a lot of times someone will think, well, if I sell a single family rental property, I have to now exchange it for a single family rental property. All real estate is intrinsically like kind with all real estate. It's really how we treat it that makes it qualify. So as long as the property is held for investment purposes, so example would be raw land, let's say that we were holding on to for appreciation, or maybe a single family rental home, a condo that we're renting out. So if it's held for investment purposes or business use, I am an attorney. Let's say I had my private practice and I have the building that I'm working out of. When I go to retire, I can sell that business use property. And actually, I can go out and buy any type of real estate as long as it's held for investment or business use. So I could sell this office building and I could replace it with a single family rental home. So as long as I am selling and buying investment or business use property, it qualifies. Sometimes it's better to look at, well, what doesn't qualify, right? Since that's such a broad definition. So what doesn't qualify is personal use property. So let's say I sell this building and now I buy that single family home, but I move into it right away. That wouldn't work for 1031 purposes, right? Because that is considered a personal use property. So if I'm selling or buying a personal use, let's say I'm selling my primary residence, and the last use is my primary, I'm living in that, it wouldn't qualify for a 1031 exchange. But we have other code sections, right? Section 121, where you have the exclusions for that. But what's interesting is that what I could do, though, is sell that building and exchange into that single family home, rent it. The rule of thumb is for 24 months. And then after the 24 months, I can convert that over into my primary residence. So that's an exciting way to have an exit strategy if we wanted to, or to possibly 1031 exchange into my dream retirement home. But there's got to be that pause, right? Because I can't sell that investment business use property and then exchange into a property that I'm going to move into right away. And one other type that also doesn't qualify that's fairly common is what's called resale property, or what we might all commonly call flip properties, right? So if I'm going to go out and buy a property with the intent to fix it up and sell it, like a flip or property held for resale, that doesn't qualify for 1031 exchange either. So again, the like-kind definition or what qualifies for 1031 exchange is pretty broad. You just got to make sure that the what we're selling and buying is held for investment or business use.
Great. Well, yeah, thanks for clarifying that. I find that a lot of clients get that a little confused, especially on what they can and can't exchange. They're thinking, as you said, you got to exchange a single family home for a single family home, commercial property for commercial property, land for land. So thanks for clarifying that. And I think you actually enlightened me a little bit on the 24-month rule on the personal residence, that that is an option that could be available for someone. Now, could you rent that property out to a family member or related party for that 24-month period and then make it your primary residence at that point and still qualify?
Yeah, you could. So we always have to be careful when we do things with related parties, right? Because the IRS is kind of convinced, well, there might be something going on there that we're circumventing the tax code. But absolutely, you can rent to a family member. But we want to make sure that when we rent to, our daughter or son, that we are receiving fair market value rent from them, right? We want to treat that rental as at an arm's length so that it qualifies for a 1031 exchange. So that would definitely work. But on that related party topic, a lot of times I get the question where I'm selling, someone calls and they ask me that they're telling me that they're selling an investment property and now they want to buy a replacement property that maybe their brother owns or sister owns. These we have to be careful with as well. It's not that we can't do a related party exchange. It's just that the related party seller really needs to be doing a 1031 as well. Or if their basis is lower than mine, meaning that they have a larger gain and paying more tax to the IRS, that would work. But all of these kind of things that pop up, if you have a good qualified intermediary, they can jump on the phone with you and kind of go over what works with these related party issues.
Yep. Well, that's good to know that there at least is an opportunity that you can do it with related parties or family. Just have to be careful on what you're charging, some other restrictions as well. So very good.
Evan, if you don't mind,
Yes.
I wanted to bring up another really good strategy that
Yeah,
might
go right ahead. Yep.
So remember I was talking about that conversion of sell investment, buy investment, then convert it over to a primary?
Yes.
Well, you almost could do the opposite. where I don't know if you've seen this with your clients, but you know, a lot of our clients have primary residences that they've been in for a very long time, right? And when they think about selling that property, they're well over their exclusion amount of 250,000 for an individual or 500,000 for a married couple. One of the possibilities is if they were to move out of that primary residence or their home that they're living in, rent that property out for, let's say, 2 years, then they go to sell it, they can use the two code sections. Section 121 for the primary residence exclusion, they would be able to receive their 250 or 500,000 if they're married, right? And they would get to do a 1031 exchange because the last use of the property is investment, right? Because it's a rental property. So the only thing with that is you'd have to exchange all of the net proceeds that you're receiving from that sale into the replacement property. You'd want to buy equal or greater value to the sales price minus the exemption amount of the 250 or 500,000. But I think that, you know, you're going to realize that I'm kind of a nerd, right? All these things I find that are so exciting,
No,
they're
it's a lot of good
absolutely
information.
exciting.
I'm the same way, just in a different capacity. So
So
very,
just a little tip there.
that's great to know. Do you see that very often where it's going that direction when it's a primary to rental and then
Yeah,
do the
sometimes we do where someone wants to move into their a bigger, nicer primary, and they decide not to sell their primary residence at that time and rent it. And if they're still in that window where they lived in it 2 out of the past 5 years and can qualify for the primary residence exclusion, that's great. Some of our clients, it might have been their primary 10, 15 years ago. So then we can't, you know, they can't take that exemption, but they can absolutely do a 1031 exchange.
Great. Well, that's good to know. And you also mentioned proceeds. I'll just touch on that real quick. How much of the proceeds from the sale of the property have to be reinvested into that replacement property in order to qualify and defer the full amount of the gain?
That's a great question. And, you know, whenever I'm speaking to someone that has not done a 1031 exchange before, because I think this is a little bit confusing, because, you know, when we look at when anyone thinks about selling a property, we kind of all know that we got to pay tax on the profit, right? But in a 1031 exchange, it's a different set of rules because the whole idea of an exchange is it's a continuation of that old investment into a new property. So what we have to do to be fully deferred, we don't have to be 100% tax deferred. We can also do a partial exchange where we pay some tax and defer some tax. But to be fully deferred, 100% tax free, we'd want to buy a property equal or greater value to the sales price, reinvest all the net proceeds. So that's after all the closing costs, real estate commissions, any kind of, you know, title insurance premium, surveys, and ordinary closing costs. Reinvest all the net proceeds. Now, there's one more thing we have to think about because a lot of our clients, these properties have mortgages that are paid off at the closing. That doesn't change the rule that we have to still buy for equal or greater value. So, in order to be fully deferred, we would have to replace the mortgage that we were relieved of, right? So, we could either do that by having another mortgage or adding cash. So we sell a property for $1 million. Let's say there's a $500,000 mortgage on that property. So the closing happens. And what's going to happen is once the real estate commissions and closing costs are paid, that title company or law office is going to wire the funds to us. And then for our client to be fully deferred, they need to buy a property of $1 million. So we'll wire out the $500,000 and our client has an option. They can either add cash to that closing, or they could get another loan, or they could decide to do a partial exchange, which is, you know, you're going to pay some tax and defer some tax. Thing is, with a 1031, however, if you sell a property for $1 million and you buy a property for 500,000, you're going to pay tax on the difference, and it's fully taxable. There is no basis offset. Right? Because a lot of times clients will say to me, well, Claudia, that doesn't make any sense, right? I purchased that property 20 years ago for $200,000. So I just want to get my money back. Well, that $200,000, which we also call tax basis, right? That's going to move over to the new property. So if we take money out, it's going to be taxed. It's going to be defined as gain, profit, taxable, right? And in our world, it's called boot, right? So anything that's taxable in exchange, that $500,000 difference in my example would be boot.
Very good. I assume in your experience, most clients are probably doing a full deferral.
You know,
Or do
it's
you?
interesting. Yeah, it just depends on the client. You know, we have some older clients that you would the amount of profit or how low, like if they had a property that they've been depreciating, right? You know, over time, there's really not much basis in it, and now they're selling that property for $2 million, and they say to me, "You know what? I want to go and buy a beautiful car, or I want to pay off debt, or I just want to enjoy myself and travel around the world." They can. They decide to sometimes do that partial exchange. For the most part, a lot of times they are, you're correct. They are aiming for full deferral, but it just depends on the client and what they want to do.
Yep. Obviously, you got a different circumstances for different folks. So, but that's very good to know that you do have that option that you could do a partial deferral, but just be aware that you would have to pay tax on that piece that's not being deferred. So, very good. You mentioned so IXP, they hold the funds until the replacement property is purchased. Is there a window that the replacement property, number of days or months that the replacement property needs to be purchased within?
So they want us, meaning the IRS or Congress, wants us moving along pretty quickly. So we have these deadlines that start at the closing of the sale of property. So if I close today on a property, I would have 45 calendar days to identify what I want to make an identification on properties, and 180 days to close on the replacement property. So they're calendar days. There are no extensions for the deadlines of 45 days or 180 days unless there is a federally declared disaster. And in order to have that disaster or take that postponement of the deadlines, you have to be located in one of those counties. And it has to be the IRS will put out a notice of the disaster, who's an affected taxpayer. And I think we still have one that's going on in West Virginia. I think that the deadlines were pushed out to sometime in November. But so we have 45 days to identify, 180 days to close. The 45-day deadline, in my opinion, is the one that is the most challenging for our clients. And the reason is because once someone identifies a property and now they're day 46 or after, if let's say they identify one property, if anything happens with that one property and they don't have anything else listed on their identification, they're out of luck. So, whatever we can do early on to get the property maybe under contract and move it along as quickly as possible, that's better, right? If I have a client that has an exchange where they're selling and buying in the first 45 days, that's great because they're never going past the identification period.
Very good.
And the other thing is, you know, they can't just send in to us an endless list of properties. They have rules, or in the Internal Revenue Code, there's rules for how many properties we can identify. And the one that's used most often, and I think that's because it's the easiest to use, is the three property rule. So if you wanted to identify more than one property, you could use the three property rule, which allows you to identify three properties of any value. But let's say we have a strategy, or a client has a strategy of diversifying. They're selling that $1 million property. Maybe they're not getting a good return on investment on that property, and now they want to go out and buy four $250,000 properties. Well, the three property rule is not going to work for them. So they could use the 200% rule, and that will allow them to identify the four properties. However, they can't add up to more than 200% of what they sold for, or double the amount of what they sold for. So they sold for $1 million. They can identify the four properties, or five, or six, as long as they don't total up to more than 2 million. And then there's one last possibility. Let's say we identify more than three, we identify five properties, and they add up to 2.5 million. Yikes, right? Well, we have this 95% exception, and that states, well, as long as the taxpayer acquires 95% of the value of what they identified, they're good. But think about that. 95% of the value of what we identified is really we're acquiring 100%, right, of what we identified. So if I'm buying all four, like in my example, then that's fine.
Well, it's obviously important with all these options and rules that you're saying that this is why it's important to have a qualified intermediary that is
Yes,
experienced
that's a hard one to
with this
say.
stuff. It is very, very difficult to say. So,
You know, Evan, in our world, we a lot of times just use QI.
QI, that's what I'm going to use from now on.
Yeah,
It's
there you go.
definitely
It's a lot easier.
a little bit of a tongue twister. So, anywho, but very, very good. So that's great. What happens if you do not meet that 45 or 80 day, 180 day rule? What happens at that point? Is it just, it sounds like you're done? Is that
Yeah, it is. The exchange would terminate, and then we start the process of returning the funds to our client, right? So if someone starts off at an exchange, the funds come over to us, and then they have 45 calendar days to identify. And let's say day 46 comes around, they have not identified, then the exchange terminates, and we would start returning the funds to them. So, you know, sometimes we have exchanges where we'll get a call from a client and they'll say, "Hey, I'm at the closing table and I want to do a 1031 exchange." So that's fine. As long as it's the day of closing, we'll get those. We have to just get, you know, the copy of the contract. We have to know who's handling the closing. But in talking to them, and I'll ask them, "Well, we'll go over the 1031 rules. We want to make sure it works for them." And then I'll ask, "Well, what are you going to buy?" And a lot of times they'll say, "Well, I don't know, but I don't want to lose the opportunity." Right. So they're starting an exchange with the idea of, well, let me see what I can go out and find. Right. And then that keeps the opportunity open, because if they had closed and were past that closing date, it's too late to do an exchange. You know, and just one other thing I wanted to mention about, I was talking about like-kind before and finding replacement properties. You know, I talked about the obvious type of replacement properties, you know, any type of real estate that we're used to that we see when we're driving around, right? Or that we live in, or single family homes. But there is the opportunity to invest in things that are very passive. So we have clients where, you know, when they were younger, they didn't mind managing their real estate. Right. And now they get to a point where you're like, you know, I'd like to travel and I don't want to get those calls about, you know, the toilet or the roof or all that. And but they've owned the property a long time and they have a lot of gain and they would owe a lot of tax if they sold it, because they feel like they're stuck, right, owning that property, because they figure, well, why do I want to sell this property and get someone else's headache, right? But there are a lot, just to let you know, there's a lot of different properties or types of investments that qualify. So, for example, some of our clients get into what's called triple net properties. That's when, you know, that's the McDonald's, CVS's you see when you're driving around, right? Many times there's someone that owns the dirt underneath, and then they have triple net's nice because all they're doing is going to their mailbox, right? That's why they call it mailbox income, because they don't have to do anything with the property. The other type that seems to be somewhat popular with some of our clients is referred to as a DST. That stands for a Delaware Statutory Trust. So that's another option. Some of our exchangers, when they start their 1031, and let's say they get to day 45 and they're like, I can't find anything, because depending on how the market is, you know, it might be a tight market and they just can't find that replacement property, they may decide to invest in one of these type of properties. And so that's also it's kind of to make an analogy, it's not really the same, but it's sort of the same, because I get that client that asks me, well, can I buy into a REIT, a real estate investment trust? And unfortunately, no, because you're not buying real estate. You're buying shares, operational units of in an entity that owns real estate. But there are a lot of similar or ways you could get into a REIT. There's what's referred to as an UPREIT that kind of gets you to that REIT. And then the Delaware statutory trust, where the difference is there's a trust that's on title, and usually the properties are kind of like student housing, assisted living, multifamily, and our client is buying a beneficial interest in the trust. The other type of like kind that's out there, this is where 1031 exchange does so much for not only our economy but environment. I do some exchanges where they're conservation easements. Especially in the state of Florida, we have a lot of that going on where I might have a client that has a ranch, right? And, I never knew before I moved to Florida how many cows and farms are in Florida. But so they would get an offer, they get offers from either the state of Florida or the Florida Land Trust saying, hey, we want to buy an easement on your property. And it's really great. It's a win-win for everyone because that farmer can get the income coming in for the conservation easement, and they can use that to go out and buy land in another area that's maybe not so environmentally vulnerable. So conservation easements or any type of perpetual easement would work. So just again, my excitement in 1031, but a lot of different types of properties work for 1031 exchange or what you wouldn't think is a property does. Intangibles, yeah.
Definitely, that's great to know those some of those outside of the box options that are available if you're not just going to do the traditional residential rental, commercial property, land. If you do want to think outside the box or your circumstances are different, you may want to look at those. It's good to know those options are available. So, Claudia, I really appreciate you being with us today. You provided a lot of quality content on 1031 exchanges. I really appreciate you being here. Before I wrap up the episode, can you give our listeners information on how they can contact you if they have additional questions, follow-ups related to 1031 exchanges?
Absolutely, I would love to. Yeah, so I hope everyone that's listening to this feels comfortable. I spend a lot of my time on the phone answering questions and going over how the 1031 exchange works. But our 800 number is 877-494-1031. My email address is my first name, Claudia, dot my last name, Kiernan, Kiernan, at ipx1031.com. Or you could go on our website, www.ipx. So that's I as investment, P as in property, X as in x-ray, 1031.com. And we have a lot of information there. All my contact information there is too. It says find a expert in your area, and you just click on the Virginia state, and I am there with all my contact information.
Wonderful. Thank you, Claudia. Well, that is a wrap for this episode of the Real Estate Tax Playbook. I appreciate everyone tuning in and listening to this episode. Again, please check out the Brown Edwards website if you have not already. Additionally, please subscribe and listen to future episodes wherever you get your podcast. Again, I'm your host, Evan Ross. I look forward to bringing you more real estate content in the future. Take care.